Ymir. And then the force of the vacuum caught hold of the hatch, and to my horror, I saw it slam shut right in front of me. I tried to pull it back open, but the suction was too strong. I cannot tell you, Marcus, how helpless and guilty I felt when I realized that Dinah was trapped on the other side. Marcus's eyes went to Ivy. He had been listening to Julia for a long time and needed a break. Ivy threw her hands up. I was trying to fly this ungainly contraption. I didn't really understand what was happening even when Julia tried to explain it to me.
Yes, Marcus said. I can't believe you were able to fly that thing at all. People will be talking about it 100 years from now.
Assuming people still exist, Dinah thought. Ivy was just regarding Marcus, blinking slowly, looking for signs that he was being sarcastic. He wasn't. The Marcus bluntness worked both ways. He could blurt out astonishingly generous compliments as easily as he could cut and burn you with his words. It sure used up all of my brain, Ivy said. They were sitting around the conference table in the tank. Marcus had not used the term inquest to describe this meeting, but that was clearly what it was, or as close as they would ever get, in any case, to a formal determination of what had happened yesterday. It had gotten off to a reasonably brisk start with a summary from Marcus, then gone off the rails as Julia had insisted on telling her story from the beginning. Which turned out to mean from the moment she had woken up in the White House next to her late husband and gone down to breakfast with her late daughter, straight through to the end of the world, and her hastily arranged launch into orbit some 36 hours later. Along the way had been a sequence of mishaps and coincidences just shaggy enough to be somewhat plausible. No liar could fabricate such a story. The narration had lasted for the better part of an hour, despite Marcus's increasingly frequent and obvious glances at his Swiss watch, and left all the others in a strange combination of spellbound, bored, horrified, and bemused. She seemed to believe that they would actually care about all of her interactions with those dead people on that dead planet. It was a common enough mistake among new arrivals. In her case, it was magnified considerably by the fact that she was used to being the president. Everyone was always happy to sit and listen to the most powerful person in the world. Thank God, Julia said, that we were able to...
Yes, Marcus said, cutting her off.
Plainly, he did not wish to hear any more from Julia. But just as plainly, he was a little reluctant to move on to the next part of the story. Everyone seemed to be pointedly not looking at Moira.
Thank you, Julia,
Marcus said, in a tone that made it clear she was free to leave now. Julia looked a bit startled. But we haven't heard from Dr. Crewe yet.
But we have heard from you, Marcus pointed out.
The point sank in. Julia didn't like it. Very well, she said, standing up carefully. As I mentioned before, Marcus, I am eager to make myself useful in any way that I can.
It is so noted, Marcus said.
He looked across the table, deadpan, at Ivy. Dinah knew what they were both thinking. You are worse than useless here, which is why you were never invited.
Thank you, Julia.
The ex-president turned away from the table. She stopped before the door leading into the farm and turned back toward Marcus one last time with a sad puppy look on her face, perhaps expecting him to just slap his thigh and laugh at the joke and warmly invite her back to her seat. When this failed to happen, a transformation came over her face that Dinah found mildly frightening to watch. What would it be like, she wondered, to be nuking people one day and less than a week later to be asked to leave a meeting? Evidently, it did not put Julia in the best of moods. JBF turned her back on them, as much to hide her face as to find the way out, and opened the door. During the few moments it was open, Dinah caught sight of a young woman in an Islamic-style face veil standing just outside of it, waiting. The bottom half of her face was covered, but her eyes brightened and her body language was warm as she saw Julia emerging. Julia reached out to her, a affectionately and laid a hand on the small of her back as she turned. The two of them walked away shoulder to shoulder as the door closed. Remaining in the tank were Marcus, Dinah, Ivy, Moira, Salvatore Guodian, and Zhong Hu, an applied mathematician who was their head theorist when it came to swarm dynamics. Others knew more about orbital mechanics and rocket engines, the old-school techniques for managing individual space vehicles' trajectories. But Hu, a specialist in complex systems, was the main architect of Perambulator, and the only person who could quite understand and explain what went wrong or right in a swarm. He'd spent most of his life in Beijing, but with enough time in Western universities to get along fine in English. In response to a nod from Marcus, he said, "I have evaluated what happened. As we already know, there was a cornering event leading to a bump." This being the polite term for a mild collision between arclets. But still, Arclet 214 had enough control authority that it could have avoided the second event.
"Then why didn't it?"
Marcus asked. "The algorithm predicted a near miss, and so it took no action beyond routine attitude corrections. The human operator was distracted and disoriented, and so was reluctant to correct course manually."
"I can't fault the human," Marcus said, "since we have warned them so many times about the consequences of flying by hand. But what went wrong with the algorithm?"
"Nothing went wrong with it," Hu said. "It had bad data. I will show you." With a few taps on his tablet, he brought up a three-dimensional model of Izzy on the big screen above the conference table. To a first approximation, this seemed reasonably up-to-date. It depicted modules and space vehicles that had been added to the complex only within the last couple of days. This is the model that the system was using yesterday for collision avoidance. Dragging his finger around on his tablet, he rotated the model on the screen so that they were looking at the nadir side. He zoomed in on the distinctive handlebar shape of the human genetic archive, the pair of cold storage units projecting to port and starboard below the Zvezda module. The view was much the same as what Dinah had seen from the flivver the day before.
"Hang on, is this the exact model? Is this everything?" Ivy asked.
"Yes," Hu said.
"This doesn't include the thermal protection," she pointed out. "That adds at least a meter to the collision envelope."
"That is correct," Hu said. "In that sense, this model is obsolete. We have replaced it now with an upgraded version." As all understood, this was no one's fault. The architects had been struggling for almost 2 years to keep their three-dimensional model of Izzy up to date and accurate, a nearly impossible task when it changed every day. Soft goods, like thermal protection blankets, tended to get a lower priority. Humans, looking at the model, would mentally add those. Computers weren't that smart.
"Still," Marcus said, "we take the model with a grain of salt. No arclet should ever pass that close."
"Let me show you what happened," Hu said, and brought up a video shot from an external camera apparently mounted on one of the trusses. The human genetic archive and its surrounding blanket of thermal protection were not centered in the frame. They were down in the lower right corner, so the camera angle wasn't ideal, but they could see what happened. The arclet approached, creeping in gradually from the port side with closing velocity no greater than a slow walk.
"Is this real time?" Sal asked.
"Yes, because it was an extremely low-speed approach. It was not viewed as terribly dangerous."
"It looks like it's going to be a near miss," Sal said.
"It was, until this," Hu said, and freeze-framed the video. It wasn't easy to make out, but they could see a tiny flash on the forward halo of Arclet 214. The thruster fires, a small course correction under automatic control. He stepped it forward. The flash faded but expanded into a dim gray cloud. Exhaust gases, expanding rapidly but moving quite fast. He stepped it forward several more frames until they could see the thermal protection blanket recoiling from the impact of the gas.
A seam parted between two adjoining blankets, and one of them flailed out like a rag caught in a wind gust. Who let the video run now, and they saw the Arklet's rear halo snag on the loose blanket and rip it away, exposing the human genetic archive to the orange radiance of Earth's atmosphere. Ivy said, "If that thruster hadn't fired at the wrong moment." Who nodded. "Arklet 214 would have passed underneath with 2 meters to spare. Not a margin to be proud of, but it would have been enough." After a pause, Hu added, "The HGA's thermal protection system could have been designed better." Another pause in which everyone else waited to see who would be the first to laugh. If it weren't for dark humor, they'd have no humor at all. Hu seemed to sense it. "What I mean is that it was engineered for normal thermal loads."
"Meaning sunshine," Dinah said. "Yes, not for radiant heat shining up from the atmosphere below." "The same is true of many parts of Izzy, of course," Marcus said. "We are having thermal overloads all over the place now. Moira, what's the damage?"
Dinah had to give Marcus credit for a kind of finesse for the offhanded way he dropped the question in. Moira, who had been quiet through the whole meeting, took a moment to snap out of her reverie.
"Well," she finally said, "as Hu said, the thermal protection system was bad," Marcus said. "We know."
"There was no backup system."
Marcus said, "Of course not. The cooling system for the HGA was the rest of the universe. We do not expect to have a backup system for the rest of the universe. We can rely upon it to be cold most of the time."
"Because of the accelerated schedule caused by the 8-ball.
"Stop,"
Dinah said. Everyone looked at her. "Let's get this over with," she said. "Look, when I was 14, one of my dad's mines collapsed and killed 11 employees. It was terrible. He never really got better. Of course he wanted to know what had happened. It turned out to be a long story. One thing led to another, which led to another. The individual steps all made sense, but no one could have seen the whole thing coming. Of course, he still felt responsible, but he wasn't in any normal sense of that word. So here's what happened," Dinah went on. "Sean Probst started an asteroid mining company that sent up a bunch of CubeSats and gathered a lot of data about near-Earth asteroids, which he kept secret. He took the database with him on his mission to Greg's skeleton. His radio got hit by a rock and destroyed, so he couldn't communicate. At the last minute, when it was basically too late, he had the idea to look at the database. He learned about the 8-ball. He alerted me. I alerted Dube. Dube alerted everyone else, and we pushed up the schedule for everything. Moira pulled the trigger on the project, which had been planned for over a year, to disperse the HGA samples to the Arklets. Like every other project in the history of the universe, it went slowly at first because all kinds of snags came up. And not only that, but all the flivvers were spoken for and all the spacesuits were busy because of the splurge. So not much got moved. It was obviously safer to keep the samples in cold storage in the HGA while all these logistical problems got sorted out. The splurge happened, and a lot of random shit got launched in our general direction and made Perambulator light up like crazy. Arklets were getting cornered on a pretty regular basis. We almost lost a couple. Ivy and I took off in the flivver to fetch Julia, and probably added a lot of other noise and chaos to that problem. Then the thing we just watched happened. Arklet 214 tore most of the badly designed thermal protection system off of the HGA and exposed it to the direct radiance of the Earth's atmosphere. The samples all warmed up before replacement thermal protection could be jury-rigged. All of those samples have been destroyed. Right, Moira?" Moira, apparently not trusting her ability to speak, nodded.
"Okay," Dinah said. "So, I think that what Marcus is really asking is how many of the samples in the HGA actually got moved to safe cold storage in other locations before this happened. In other words, how many survived?"
Moira cleared her throat and said in a faint voice, "About 3% of them."
"Okay. I only have one other question," Marcus said. "Have you talked to Dube?"
"I'm sure he suspects," Moira said. "But I have not officially broken the news to him. I wanted to be absolutely sure first.
Are you sure now?
Yes.
Marcus nodded and spent a few moments thumbing something into his phone.
I am inviting him to join me and Moira here immediately, he said.
Everyone who was not Marcus or Moira stood up to leave. Marcus held up his hand to stay them.
Before you go, let me say something about the human genetic archive that was lost.
He then paused for effect until everyone was looking at him.
It was always bullshit, he said.
Everyone took a moment to consider it. Are you going to tell Dube that? Ivy asked.
Of course not, Marcus said. But the real purpose of the HGA was politics on Old Earth.
Is that what we're calling it now? Old Earth?
Sal asked, fascinated.
That's what I am calling it, Marcus said, in the increasingly rare moments when I actually think about it.
Thank you, Marcus, Moira said.
He had known, of course. Izzy's complexity was so great as to belie its tiny size. A few hundred people sorted into a volume the size of a few jetliners. News traveled fast. Everyone had known within a few hours that the human genetic archive had been almost completely destroyed. He was in the tank with Marcus and Moira. They were gazing across the table at him, patiently awaiting some kind of reaction.
Look,
he finally said.
Doc Dubois is no more. That was a persona, you understand? Just an act. I'm a private person. I do not spontaneously emote, especially when people are watching me and expecting it. A year from now, when I'm alone, when I least expect it, I'll break down in sobs over this. But not now. It's not that I don't feel, but my feelings are my own.
I am very sorry that it happened, Moira said.
Thanks,
Dube said.
But let me say what all of us are thinking. 7 billion people died yesterday. Compared to that, the loss of some genetic samples is nothing. The embryo that Amelia and I created together, and that I brought up here with me, well, that was a special favor that JBF granted me as an incentive to come up here. No one else got that kind of special treatment. It was unfair. I knew it. I accepted it anyway. So here we are.
Yes, Marcus said. Here we are. Going forward.
But I'm not sure I agree with you,
Dube said,
that the HGA was so insignificant.
Marcus bridled his impatience and raised his eyebrows. Dube looked at Moira.
What was the term you used? Heterozygosity?
Yes, Moira said. The stated purpose of the HGA was to ensure a sufficiently diverse genetic basis for the human race.
Sounds important to me, Dube said. What am I missing?
We have tens of thousands of human genomes recorded in digital form, from all different parts of the world.
So there's your heterozygosity. That's what you're saying,
Dube prompted her.
That's why,
he glanced at Marcus,
the HGA wasn't really needed.
Yes, but there's a but, Moira said.
Okay, what's the but?
The digitized sequences, as I'm sure you'll understand, are only useful so long as we have the equipment needed to transcribe them into functional chromosomes in viable human cells. By contrast, to make use of a sperm sample, all we need is a turkey baster and some lube. But to make use of a DNA sequence stored on a thumb drive, we need...
All of the equipment in your lab,
Dube said.
Moira looked a bit impatient. What you are referring to as my lab bears the same relationship to a proper lab as some ones and zeros on a thumb drive does to a living human. It is a collection of crated equipment that cannot even be unpacked and used in zero gravity. And even if we set it all up and turned it all on, it would be useless without a staff of PhD-level molecular biologists.
Really? Useless?
Marcus asked.
Moira sighed. For small-scale work, one sample at a time, well, that is easier. But to reconstruct a genetically diverse human population...
But Moira, Marcus said, we cannot do that anyway until so many other things are in place. A large population cannot live in arklets eating algae. We need to establish a viable and safe colony first. Then we build your lab. Then we create a more diverse ecosystem, better food, greater stability. Only then do we even begin to worry about the heterozygosity of the human population. Until that time, we have more than enough people to create healthy, non-inbred children just by the usual process of fucking each other.
That is all true, Moira said, and that is the basis of my statement that the HGA was bullshit,
Marcus concluded.
You're saying,
Dube said,
that if we had all of the prerequisites in place, the colony, the ecosystem, the talent, needed to actually exploit the HGA...
We would no longer need it. Yes, this is my point, Marcus said. Can we please stop wasting time on it now?
How would you prefer to be spending time, Marcus?
Moira asked, giving Marcus an amused, owlish look through her glasses.
Talking about how to get there. How to realize that situation we were just talking of.
And how might I contribute to that, given that the HGA is 97% destroyed and none of my equipment will be usable for a long time?
I want to talk of preserving that equipment,
Marcus said.
Preserving it against all hazards, and then getting it to a safe situation where we can one day construct this laboratory you speak of.
It's about as safe as we can make it, isn't that so?
Moira asked.
It was given a sort of privileged position off of Node X, quite close to Amalthea. It's not living dangerously the way we are at the moment.
She was referring to the notion, frequently discussed by architects, of the cone of protection that supposedly existed in the Lee of Amalthea. To the extent that the paths of incoming bolides were predictable, Amalthea could be pointed into them and used as a sort of battering ram. The forward surface of the asteroid would take a beating, but a solid slug of ancient nickel and iron could survive quite a lot. Anything situated up against its aft surface would be sheltered against virtually all hazards. But the protected zone did not, of course, stretch back infinitely far. The farther you lagged behind Amalthea, the more likely you were to get hit by a bolide coming in from an off angle. The mining colony was in the safest position since, by its nature, it had to be right up against the asteroid. Almost as safe was the cluster of modules connected to Node X, immediately aft of the scrum, which was where all of Moira's gear had been stashed. Behind that, the protected zone narrowed, a long, acute cone, finally disappearing altogether somewhere aft of the caboose. When Moira joked about living dangerously, she referred to the fact that T3, the third torus, in which they were sitting now, was rather wide and rather far aft, placing it close to the limits of that cone. Efforts had been made to beef up its shielding, but it was still at higher risk than many other parts of Izzy. Marcus nodded.
Your stuff is pretty safe, but it would be safer if we moved it inside of Amalthea. I've talked to Dinah about it. She says that they could mine out cavities and store things of great importance there.
A silence while Dube and Moira pondered it. On one level, Marcus's proposal was perfectly obvious. Of course, anything would be safer inside of a huge metal asteroid. On another level, it had ramifications. As of a few days ago, pre-White Sky, the last time anyone had been able to think straight, the fate of Amalthea and the mining colony had still been subject to debate. Was the asteroid the boulder in the wheelbarrow that had to be dumped, or was it the aegis that would shelter the entire human race? The argument had come down to statistics. They just didn't have enough data to make a decision. By suggesting that Moira's equipment be moved into the interior of Amalthea, Marcus seemed to be committing to a specific course of action. It was a course that Doob instinctively agreed with, but it was a bit strange for a man like Marcus to just decide on a course of action before the numbers were in. Or did he know something Doob didn't? Moira, in any case, went first. What if we dump and run? She was referring to a gambit, frequently discussed and wargamed, in which Amalthea would be cut loose and abandoned. And Izzy, lightweight but unprotected, would boost herself to a higher orbit with fewer bolides flying around in it.
Then we would simply have to move all of that stuff back to Node X first, Marcus said, or wherever we felt the safest.
This elicited a searching look from Moira. Marcus held up his hands.
But I take your point. I am increasingly biased against dump and run.
You know how I feel about the Swarma Mentalists, Moira said.
She was referring to another of the basic gambits, pure swarm, in which everything, presumably, including Moira's lab, would be distributed among arclets, which would then collectively move to higher orbit. People and goods would move among them through a decentralized, market-based economy.
Listen, Marcus said. Now that everyone below is dead, and we don't have to put up so much with bullshit, you will find that Hu and the others have a more nuanced view than they were letting on before.
He referred to the fact that Zhang Hu, as the foremost swarm theorist and the brains behind Perambulator, was assumed to be a swarmamentalist. Doob nodded. It still took some effort to remind himself that the millions of internet commentators arguing for this or that strategy were all ghosts now.
You know something,
Doob blurted out. Then, as the thought was coming into his head, he added,
From Dinah, the radio.
Yes, Marcus said. Ymir is coming in hot, high, and heavy.
He surrounded those three words with air quotes.
What does that mean? Moira asked. She's made of ice. How can she be hot?
She is approaching with a high closing velocity. Not unmanageable, but somewhat exciting.
And high,
Doob prompted him.
Sean also transmitted his params, Marcus said. It would seem that he did us a large favor. He executed the plane change while it was still easy to do so, way out around L1.
So when he says he's coming in high,
Doob said,
he means that Ymir has a high orbital inclination, close to ours.
Very close to ours, Marcus confirmed. He is dropping this big chunk of ice into our lap.
So, Moira said, on top of everything else, Sean Probst is now preparing to dive bomb us with a comet.
A piece of one.
A big piece,
Doob guessed.
If he specified heavy.
The number was impressive.
As Marcus said this, he shifted toward Doob and looked him in the eye.
Oh, wow,
Doob said.
Is it enough for the big ride?
If we can get Ymir to rendezvous with Izzy, then yes,
Marcus said.
It is more than enough.
The big ride was the third of the basic options. It meant to boost Izzy in its entirety, Amalthea and all, to a much higher orbit. It had been considered implausible because of the amount of propellant that would be needed. Not just implausible, but, absent the timely return of Ymir, physically impossible. Despairing of Sean's chances, its supporters had lately tended to suggest scaled-down variants, such as reshaping a small percentage of Amalthea into bolide deflectors and ditching most of its mass.
Including the plane change,
Doob asked. A trace of a smile came onto Marcus's face. He knew exactly what Doob was thinking. For, unable to get cleft out of his head, Doob had shown pictures of his favorite piece of the moon to Marcus, to Conrad, to Ulrika, and Ivy, and some of the others who seemed to make up the informal power structure of the Cloud Ark.
"Let me be clear," Marcus said. "When I speak of the Beak Ride, I mean it for real. We take all of Amalthea with us, we raise the orbit to the moons, we change the plane, we circularize, and we end up safe and sound in Cleft."
"And Ymira carries enough water for that mission?"
"Yes," Marcus said, "if we can control her and bring her in."
"Isn't that Sean Probst's job?" Moira asked.
"Not anymore," Marcus said. "The information I just imparted to you was in Sean's final transmission."
Moira and Doob looked at him sharply.
"The health situation has been not so good for a long time," Marcus explained. "Sean was the last member of the expedition to die."
"Are you saying that Ymir is a ghost ship?"
Doob asked.
"Yes."
"And there's no way to remote control her?"
Moira guessed.
"Unfortunately, Dinah's Morse code cannot help us in that regard," Marcus agreed.
"So someone has to go and..."
"Someone has to go and land on that fucking big piece of ice," Marcus said. "And get inside of Ymir and restart the nuclear reactor and commit the final burns that will bring her into sync with Izzy."
"Who the hell..."
Doob began. But Marcus cut him off by pointing to himself. He did this in a somewhat awkward fashion that, deliberately or not, looked like a pantomime of suicide by handgun. He said,
"I am placing Ivy in command of Izzy and the Cloud Ark tomorrow. I am assembling a crew that will depart in an MIV and make a rendezvous with Ymir. We will board her and manually execute the procedures needed to bring her under control and get her payload to Izzy. We will then use what is left of the ice to raise Izzy's orbit, and we will bring Amalthea with us on the Big Ride."
"That's major," Moira said. "Who knows? When were you going to announce it?"
"I just decided it now," Marcus sighed. "Listen, it is the only way. In my heart, I always considered Dump and Run and Pure Swarm both to be too risky. What happened with the HGA just makes this more obvious. The only wise course is the Big Ride. It will take a long time, 2 years or something. But during all that time, the most important resources can be sheltered within Amalthea. And by that, I mean you and your equipment, Moira. You can have whatever resources you need from the mining colony to create a safe location for the genetics lab."
"Okay," Moira said.
"I'll talk to Dinah."
"Talk to whomever she delegates," Marcus said. "Dinah is going to have to come with me on the expedition. I need her to deal with all those verdammt robots."
"How can I help?"
Doob asked. He wondered if Marcus might dragoon him as well, and was torn between being afraid of that and tremendously excited.
"Figure out how we are going to do it," Marcus said, after considering it for a few moments. "Lay in a course for Cleft."
"Yes," Doob said. "I'll do that."
The little boy in him was crestfallen that he wasn't going on the adventure. Then he reminded himself that he was already part of the biggest adventure ever, and that, so far, it had been altogether miserable. All conversations worth having about space voyages were couched in terms of Delta V, meaning the increase or decrease in velocity that had to be imparted to a vehicle en route. For, in a common bit of mathematical shorthand, the Greek letter delta was used to mean the amount of change in, and V was the obvious abbreviation for velocity. The words delta V, then, were what you heard when engineers read those symbols aloud. Since velocity was measured in meters per second, so was delta V. The delta Vs bandied about in spaceflight discussions tended to be large by the standards of what Marcus was now calling old Earth. The speed of sound, for example, aka Mach 1, was 300 and some meters per second, and most earthbound people would consider it awfully damned fast. But it hardly rose to the notice of most people who talked about space missions. A common Delta-V benchmark had been the amount needed to get something from an old Earth launch pad to an orbit like Izzy's. This was some 7,660 meters per second, or more than 22 times the speed of sound. An impossible figure for any object that had to fight its way through an atmosphere. Once a vehicle had reached the vacuum of space, though, things became simpler. Rocket engines worked more efficiently, drag and aerodynamic buffeting were absent, and the consequences of failure weren't invariably catastrophic. Getting it from point A to point B was a matter of hitting it with the right delta V at the right time. Sean Probst's delta V history, from his departure from Earth until his departure from life, had gone something like this. The launch from Terra Firma to Izzy on day 68 had required a delta V of 7,660 meters per second, according to a naive calculation. But as any old space hand would know, losses due to atmospheric friction and the need to push back against gravity would have elevated the practical number to more like 8,500 or 9,000. Once he had collected Lars and most of Dinah's robots, Sean had needed to execute a plane change maneuver to get from the Izzy orbit, which was angled at about 56 degrees to the equator, to the equatorial orbit in which Ymir was being assembled. This was one of those circumstances in which human intuition got it all wrong. The Izzy orbit and the Ymir orbit did not seem all that different in most respects. Both of them were a few hundred kilometers above the atmosphere. Both were essentially circular, as opposed to elliptical, and both went in the same direction around the Earth. The only real difference between them was that they were at different angles. And yet, the delta V required to get from one to the other was large enough that it had been necessary to launch a separate rocket, carrying nothing but extra propellant, just to refuel Sean's vehicle in preparation for the plane change burn. Once Ymir had been assembled, a delta V of some 3,200 meters per second had been needed to place her in a very elongated elliptical orbit that had taken her out to L1. En route, the plane change problem had once again reared its head. Essentially, everything in the solar system, including comet Grigg-Skellerup, was confined to a flat disk centered on the sun. The imaginary plane through that disk was called the ecliptic. Conveniently for people who liked seasons, but not so good for interplanetary travelers, Earth's axis and equator were angled with respect to the ecliptic by 23.5 degrees. And so, Ymir's initial orbit had been off-kilter by that amount. Fortunately, plane change maneuvers were much less expensive, meaning they required a lot less delta V, when they were performed far away, and Ymir was, of course, going very far away. So they had done the plane change out at L1 range, as part of the same burn, totaling some 2,000 meters per second, that took her out through the L1 gate into heliocentric orbit. That orbit, more than a year later, had intersected that of comet Grigg-Skellerup. As Ymir had drawn near to the comet core, she had used another 2,000 meters per second of delta V to sync her orbit with its. All of these maneuvers, up to the arrival at Grigg-Skellerup, had been achieved by using Ymir's rocket engines, which were altogether conventional. They burned propellants, fuel and oxidizer, in a chamber, making hot gas, which was vented out of a nozzle to produce thrust. The final burn had emptied her propellant tanks, so this was a one-way journey unless the nuclear propulsion system could then be turned on. No engine had ever been made that was capable of pushing a comet core around the solar system at any appreciable speed. For that, they had needed to embed the nuke on a stick into the heart of the ice payload, construct an ice nozzle behind it, and then pull out the control blades, causing the reactor's 1,600 fuel rods to become very hot. Ice turned to water, then steam, which shot out the nozzle and produced an amount of thrust actually capable of making a difference. So, a few months had then been consumed disassembling Ymir and integrating its parts into a chunk of ice carved off the 3-kilometer ball. The question might have been asked, why just a piece of it? Why not bring the whole comet core back, if water was so desirable? What was the point of sending a large nuclear reactor into space if you weren't going to use it? And the answer lay in the fact that even a large nuclear reactor did not even come close to having enough power to move such a big piece of ice. The mission would have lasted more than a century, assuming the existence of some kind of a miracle reactor that could operate at full power for that long. In order to get this done in any reasonable amount of time, they could only bring back the bare minimum of ice needed to rendezvous with Izzy and accomplish the big ride. In any case, Sean and his surviving band had used the nuclear engine to impart a delta V of about 1,000 meters per second to the shard they had carved off Greg's skeleton, thereby placing it into a somewhat different orbit that had, a few months later, glided into L1. Sean had remained alive just long enough to yank out the control blades one last time and execute a delta V that had basically reversed the maneuver they'd used to leave the L1 gate almost 2 years earlier. This had simultaneously brought Ymir into geocentric orbit while executing, as cheaply as possible, the plane change needed to enable a later rendezvous with Izzy. A couple of days later, Sean had tapped out the coming in hot, high, and heavy message and dropped dead, of what they could only conjecture. A retrieval team that was now being organized by Marcus was going to use a MIV, or Modular Improvised Vehicle, assembled from a kit of parts. A sort of Lego set for the construction of spaceships, neatly sorted on a stack of modules, collectively known as the shipyard, connected to the caboose. The shipyard was a generally T-shaped contraption. One arm of the T's crossbar, projecting from the port side of the caboose, was studded with MIV parts. The opposite arm was a cluster of spherical tanks surrounding a collection of splitters. These used electrical power to split water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen and piped them to chillers which refrigerated the gases until they became cryogenic liquids that could be stored in the bulging tanks. So much for the T's crossbar. Its long vertical stroke was a truss terminated by a nuclear reactor. Not a small RTG, like the ones on the arklets, but a true reactor, originally designed to power a submarine, considerably souped up for this task. Marcus dubbed the shipyard's first product New Caird, after a small boat that had been used in Shackleton's expedition to Antarctica. She was assembled and made ready for use in 10 days, about one-third of the time they estimated it would take for Ymir to arc in from L1 and make her closest pass to Earth. To design, assemble, and test such a vehicle so quickly would have been unthinkable 2 years ago. During the interval between Zero and the White Sky, however, the engineering staffs of several Earthbound space agencies and private space companies had foreseen the future need to jury-rig space vehicles from standard parts such as arklet hulls and existing rocket engines, and had provided a kit of parts, lists of procedures, and some basic designs that could be adapted to serve particular needs. In effect, New Caird had been designed a year ago by a large team of engineers on the ground, all but three of whom were now dead. Those three had been sent up to join the general population. Building on their predecessors' work, they were able to produce a general design, enough to begin pulling the bits together anyway, within a few hours of Marcus's decision. Details emerged from their CAD systems as they were needed over the following week and a half. and the necessary parts and modules were shuttled about the shipyard until the new vehicle was ready. New Caird would have to execute one burn to reach an orbit that would intersect Ymir's and another to match her velocity, so that the crew could board the ghost ship and take the helm. The total mission Delta V for that journey, from its departure from the docking port on Izzy to its arrival at a similar docking port on Ymir, was some 8,000 meters per second. The conversation turned now to mass ratio, a figure second only to Delta V in its importance to space mission planning. It simply meant how much propellant the vehicle needed at the start of the journey in order to affect all the required Delta Vs. Laypersons tended to substitute fuel or gas for propellant, making the obvious analogy to the stuff that had been burned by the engines of cars and airplanes. It wasn't a bad analogy, but it was incomplete. In addition to fuel, most rocket engines needed some kind of oxygen-rich chemical, ideally just pure oxygen, with which to burn it. Cars and planes had simply used air. Rockets stored the oxidizer in a separate tank from the fuel until the moment of use. The two chemicals were collectively referred to as propellant, and their combined weight and volume tended to dominate space vehicle design in a way that hadn't been true of, say, automobiles, whose gas tanks had been small compared to their overall size. A convenient figure for characterizing that was the mass ratio, which was how much the vehicle weighed at the beginning, including the propellant, divided by how much it weighed at the end, when all the tanks had been emptied. If you knew how good the engine was and how much delta V you needed, then the mass ratio could be calculated using a simple formula named after the Russian scientist Tsiolkovsky, who was credited with having worked it out. It was an exponential, a fact that explained almost everything about the economics and technology of spaceflight. For if you found yourself on the wrong side of that exponential equation, you were completely screwed. When the relevant numbers for the Ymir retrieval mission were jacked into the Tsiolkovsky equation, the result was a mass ratio of about 7, meaning that for every kilogram of stuff, Marcus, Dinah, other personnel, miscellaneous robots, etc., that they wanted to arrive safely at the docking port of Ymir, they needed to allow for 6 kilograms of propellant at the moment of departure from Izzy. This wasn't all that difficult to achieve, especially for a vehicle that would never be exposed to the rigors of passage through the atmosphere. The payload in this case was a single arclet hull that had been augmented with a side door, an airlock that could accommodate one person in a spacesuit. Other than that, it had been stripped to the minimum complement of equipment needed to keep a crew of 4 alive for a few days. To its mass, of course, needed to be added that of the actual humans and their food and other essentials. The lightness of a bare arclet hull was startling. The newer hulls, made of overwrapped composites, weighed in at 80 kilograms. Stripped of everything that made it comfortable and inhabitable over the long term, and including the side door, the maneuvering thrusters, and a reasonable supply of thruster propellant, the mass of New Caird was about 10 times that. The humans weighed 300 kilograms. The rocket motor that would be doing all the important burns weighed another 2,000. So, in round numbers, the payload mass, the stuff that actually had to get delivered to the docking port of Ymir, was some 3,500 kilograms. The mass ratio of 7 meant that its propellant load, at the beginning, was going to be some 21,000 kilograms of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. The shipyard had been stocked with several cryogenic propellant tanks of various sizes, some designed to hold LH2, liquid hydrogen, and others built to the somewhat different specifications needed in the case of LOX, liquid oxygen. The chosen tanks were bolted together in a stack with the rocket engine mounted below and thermal protection wrapped all about. New Caird proper, the arclet with the humans in it, projected forward on a scrap of scaffolding just long enough that her maneuvering thrusters wouldn't damage any of the other parts when they came on. While the MIV was being constructed, 21,000 kilograms of water had to be split into hydrogen and oxygen, chilled to cryogenic temperatures, and stored. The shipyard's port side already had some LH2 and LOX pre-made. In general, though, they tended not to keep a lot of them on hand, because they were tiresome substances to work with. The demand was supplied by the naval reactor on the shipyard's long arm, which was brought up to full power for the first time since it had been launched, piece by heavy piece, from Cape Canaveral on a series of heavy lift rockets. Pumping juice down heavy cables to the splitters, it was able to turn 21 tons of water into gases and chill the gases to cryogenic temperatures while the other preparations were being made. This was a lot of water, roughly 14 liters of it for every surviving human. The Cloud Ark recycled water, of course, and was far from running out of the stuff. Nonetheless, the idea of taking that much of it and spewing it into outer space, never to be recovered, gave many people pause, especially the dump-and-run partisans. There was a strong counter-argument, which was that New Caird's objective was to take possession and control over a piece of frozen water that weighed as much as Izzy herself, including the giant piece of iron to which Izzy was attached, and would continue to be if the Big Ride advocates had their way. Once New Caird had reached her, Ymir could presumably be slowed down and brought to a rendezvous with Izzy by firing her engine. And that was a primitive beast. But it had a basically infinite supply of energy in the nuclear reactor and a vast stock of propellant in the form of ice. The steampunk propulsion system had much lower efficiency, however, than a properly engineered rocket motor. Consequently, the mass ratio that would be needed to slow Ymir down from the high-speed elliptical orbit with which it was falling into Earth's gravity well to match the much slower circular orbit of Izzy was about 34, which meant that 97% of the ice currently attached to Ymir was going to be melted, turned into steam, and jetted out its makeshift nozzle just to slow it down. The remaining 3%, however, would still weigh as much as Izzy and Amalthea put together. Split into hydrogen and oxygen, it would supply the rocket fuel needed to power the Big Ride, all the way up to Cleft.
"I didn't expect it to be black," Dinah said.
She was hearing her own voice as if down a mile-long sewer pipe. She was pretty sure she had lost consciousness a minute ago. Maybe she wasn't all the way back yet. Marcus was slow in responding. Maybe he had blacked out, too. Maybe he was just distracted.
"Comet cores are covered in..."
"Stinky black stuff, yeah, I know that, Marcus. Remember who I am?"
"Sorry. Not enough blood in brain."
"But this is just a shard that Sean broke off of Grig Skellerup. Why is it all covered?"
"I don't know," Marcus said.
They were looking at Ymir from a distance of 10 kilometers and closing. They were viewing her on their tablets through a zoomed-in video camera. Vyacheslav Dubsky, floating closest to New Caird's forward end, put his face to the vessel's tiny window and searched the black sky for the black ship, but the squint on his face suggested it was still too far away for naked eyes to be of much use.
"Maybe he was doing us a favor," Dinah said. "The black stuff has all kinds of goodies on it. Carbon, obviously, but also nitrogen, potassium."
"Micronutrients," Marcus said, "that the Cloud Ark will be needing."
"So maybe he used the robots to scrape some of it off Greg's skeleton and load it up on the gunk," Dinah speculated.
"We will know soon,"
Vyacheslav said.
"Presumably, he left a document."
"Which we will not be alive to read unless we stick the landing," Marcus pointed out. "So, no more chatter from now on, please.
Slava.
And he broke into a string of bad Russian, meaning something like, I trade places with you now. Vyacheslav responded in equally bad German. Both men were perfectly fluent in English, but they made a private joke of butchering each other's languages, ostensibly as part of a project to preserve Old Earth's linguistic heritage. Marcus then added,
The rest of you, buckle up.
With the deft movements of one who had been in space for 2 years, Vyacheslav glided aft. He was one of the veteran Russian spacewalkers who had come up to Izzy way back on A plus 0.17, in the first launch after the moon had blown up. He had been a mainstay of the Scout and Pioneer eras, racking up more time in a suit than anyone, wearing out 3 Orlans. He was a little worn out, too, being sallow and gaunt, compared to the strapping hero who had emerged 2 years ago from the same Soyuz that had carried Rhys and Bowler Erdene. Marcus replaced him at the forward window and buckled himself into the pilot's seat. Behind that was a row of 3 acceleration couches, mounted on a frame that spanned a diameter of the Arklet's hull. Dinah was loosely belted in on the port side. A few minutes ago, she had been tightly belted in. She had not adjusted the straps. The entire couch and its supporting truss had been deformed by the same burst of G-forces that had left her so woozy. To starboard was Jiro Suzuki, a nuclear engineer who had been involved with the design of Ymir's nuclear reactor core. It wasn't clear whether he was conscious, but then it never was with Jiro. Vyacheslav, the 4th member of Nukaird's complement, settled into the middle position and pulled the top straps of the 5-point harness over his shoulders. A staccato burst sounded from the gamma spectrometer, the modern equivalent of a Geiger counter, floating in front of Jiro's face. Then the inspector, as they called this device in butchered Russian, dropped back into the normal sporadic patter. Radiation was striking the inspector and their bodies, all the time, at random moments and in no particular pattern. Sometimes there would be a little burst, and that part of the mind that liked to see meaning in everything would identify it as an event. But then it would die away and be forgotten. That was just the way of the universe, and of the human psyche. There was a lot more radiation in space than there had been down on the ground, but all the survivors had long since come to terms with that. And Jiro had dialed down the sensitivity on his inspector so that it wasn't screaming at them all the time. If it started screaming in the next few minutes, it wouldn't be because of some faraway cosmic event. It would be because of a radiation leak from Ymir.
"Starting to see the exhaust trail?" Marcus commented. "Can you see it on video?" "It's faint. And the sunlight hits it perfectly a few hundred meters aft of the nozzle bell."
He was referring to a thread of steam that emerged from Ymir all the time, even when her engine wasn't powered up. This was how Conrad and Dub and the other astronomers aboard Izzy had been able to track the ship's course using their optical telescopes and to verify that the params encoded in Sean's last transmission had been accurate. Wispy as it was, the steam trail reflected more light than did the ship itself. It was created by the slow, steady boiling of ice caused by the latent radioactivity in the ship's fuel rods. When the control blades were pulled out and the reactor operated full blast, which was almost never, it produced 4 gigawatts of thermal power by splitting uranium and plutonium into smaller nuclei, many of which were themselves unstable isotopes. As these fission fragments decayed into daughters and granddaughters, heat continued to be generated even when the reactor had been shut down. There was nothing that could stop it, so some loss of ice, in the form of this tenuous trail of steam, was unavoidable. It was okay. Ymir had plenty more where that came from, and Sean would have allowed for it in his calculations. Sean, never the most emotionally sharing kind of guy, further throttled by his makeshift radio, had not supplied details as to what had killed him and his crew. Had it been some kind of disastrous problem with the reactor core, he probably would have given them a heads up. For that matter, Ymir wouldn't have made it this far if the system hadn't been basically working. So Jiro was not coming into this thing expecting a total nightmare. But there was no telling. No one spoke for several minutes as Marcus monitored their approach and occasionally touched the controls, spanking New Caird into a slightly different course. They had gotten here by means of two large burns. The first and smaller had placed them into an ellipse that had shot beyond the orbit of the former moon. After several days of weightless coasting away from the Earth, they had succumbed to the force of gravity, looped lazily around, and begun to fall back again toward the burning planet. This had been timed in such a way that, about a day later, they would be overtaken by Ymir, coming in on a roughly parallel track. But Ymir was traveling much faster, coming in hot, as Sean had told them, basically because it had been falling in toward the Earth from an extremely high starting place, gathering speed relentlessly for weeks. Left unmolested, Ymir would come screaming in toward Earth with a relative velocity of some 12,000 meters per second, make a hairpin turn just a few kilometers shy of a catastrophic encounter with the glowing atmosphere, then go hurtling back outward again, not to return for a couple of months. Eventually, her orbit would decay to the point where she would get dragged down by the atmosphere and destroyed. At any rate, she would have flashed by New Caird too quickly even to be seen, her relative velocity faster than that of a rifle bullet, had New Caird not just matched her velocity by making a long, precisely timed burn of her main engine. The four members of the crew were still recovering from this. The vehicle's main engine was oversized. The kit of MIV parts from which she'd been built only had so many options. And so the G-forces had been impressive at the beginning of the burn and brutal toward the end, as the lavish expenditure of propellant had made her lighter and lighter compared to the engine's formidable thrust. If Dinah had blacked out for a few seconds, why, maybe that was just as well. Given that they had aimed themselves almost squarely at the Earth, and then launched themselves at it as if on a suicide run. This was necessary in order to go where Ymir was going, but added up to maybe a little more excitement than she really was in the mood for at this moment in her life. Earth was, of course, completely unrecognizable. From this distance, it was about the size of a tangerine held at arm's length, and about the same color. Formerly, a cool, blue-and-white lake in the cosmos, it now hung there like a blob of molten steel thrown out by a welder's torch. In the belt between the tropics, where most of the hard rain was falling, it glowed orange. The color faded and reddened to a kind of sullen brown around the poles, and the whole planet continually sparkled with the bluish light of vaporizing and exploding bolides. In a few days, it would blot out half of the sky for a hectic few minutes while they slingshotted around it. By that time, they needed to have Ymir's main propulsion up and running so that they could execute the huge braking burn that would slow her down to the same velocity as Izzy. It was crazy. It was a crazy plan. The crushingly high acceleration that they had survived at the end of the big burn a few minutes ago was a physical reminder that they had only taken enough propellant to sink New Caird with Ymir. If they failed in their basic mission, if they couldn't dock with Ymir and get her engine working, they had no way of getting back to Izzy, save perhaps by the utterly insane measure of diving into Earth's atmosphere on their next pass and using the air to slow them down. Dinah had been a little slow to absorb the full meaning of the little ship's name. The James Caird was a small boat that Shackleton had used to make a desperate run for help to save the remnant of his failed South Pole expedition. They had aimed it at South Georgia Island, a speck on the map, in the knowledge that if they didn't hit it spot on, the prevailing winds would never allow them to turn around and make another try. She wondered if that very craziness wasn't Marcus attempting to make a point. The overall situation of the human race was, of course, ludicrously desperate. Doob had been the first to point this fact out in public 2 years ago. Planning and preparation had consumed the time since. The work had been hasty, improvised, and politically inflected, but fundamentally, it had been a well-ordered and methodical engineering project, as it had to be. But its plodding, bureaucratic nature had a kind of lulling effect. How many times in the last 2 years had Dinah leaned back from a screen full of code and forcibly reminded herself of what was going on and how bad it was? Unable to keep that squarely in their minds, the 1,500 or so survivors tended to live from one day to the next and keep doing what they had done the day before. Of all people, Sean Probst had been the least susceptible to that. He had seen what needed to be done almost immediately, and he had made efforts to do it that had been fantastically strenuous and, in the end, fatal. With his final transmission, he had passed that responsibility on to Marcus. Dinah suspected that Marcus had stepped away from his position at the top of the org chart and set out on this mission, partly to set an example for everyone else. And if that was true, bringing Dinah along was to make a point as well. He would spare no one, play no favorites. Marcus broke the silence once during the approach.
"Definitely a shard, as you said. Not snowball. Not candle."
"I agree," Dinah said. She could see its shape clearly enough now on the screen of her tablet. Unlike normal ships, which carried their propellant in tanks, Ymir was a big chunk of solid propellant, ice, inhabited by a sort of parasitical infestation of equipment whose purpose was to convert that propellant into thrust. Not knowing exactly what he would find on Comet Grig Skellerup, Sean had come equipped with more than one alternative architecture for putting Ymir together. If the Comet Core had turned out to be a loose ball of ice dust, then he'd have had to scoop out what he needed and pack it into something like a snowball, giving Ymir a spherical shape with the reactor embedded in its center. Another option would have been to fashion a long cylinder of ice and plant the reactor in one end of it, then burn it forward, consuming the ice en route, like a candle. What they were seeing now looked more like the third architecture, which was the shard. It suggested that, upon his rendezvous with Grig Skellerup, Sean had found it made up of at least one fairly hard and solid crystal that could be relied on to hold itself together structurally during the maneuvers to come. He had split the shard off from the main body of the comet and planted the reactor system somewhere near its middle, then embedded the rest of his ship, the part where the humans lived, in what would become its nose. If the equipment had worked as planned, then executing the burns, i.e. pulling out the control blades to place the reactor into operation and make steam, had been a matter of sending signals to actuators embedded in the core, motors that would move the rods, valves that would control the flow of steam and water, and so forth. Implicit in all of this was a hell of a lot of robot activity, which was why Sean had taken the extraordinary step of traveling personally to Izzy to clean out Dinah's supply of them before proceeding to his rendezvous with Ymir. The reactor had to be fed with ice. Because ice was a solid, it couldn't flow through tubes. Robots had to mine ice from the shard and transfer it to a feed system, a set of augers that would move it into the reactor chamber to be melted and vaporized. A Siwi robot could move a lot of material in a hurry by embedding its tail in the ice and then using a whirring mill on its head to throw off a fountain of fine shavings that could be collected and carried off by gnats. The long intervals of time between burns could be used to store up a supply of shredded ice in hoppers that would feed the augers. Downstream of the engine, robots were also needed to maintain the shape of the rocket nozzle. This was a long duct with a wide mouth on the aft face of the shard, tapering to a narrow throat near the reactor. The throat had been constructed on Earth and launched up with the reactor. It was made of a corrosion-resistant alloy called Inconel. Any other material would rapidly wear out from the hot steam blasting through it. Conditions in the long spreading bell of the nozzle, however, were more benign, and so it worked fine for that to be sculpted from ice. Nonetheless, it changed its shape as it was used. Deeper in, where the exhaust was hot, it grew wider as its walls were melted by the torrent of steam. Closer to the exit, where the exhaust had cooled to below freezing, it accumulated on the walls and narrowed the passage. So robots had to scuttle around, reshaping the nozzle. This was a fine task for the gnats that Lars had experimented with in Seattle. Finally, there was a third crew of robots living on the exterior surface of the shard, trying to keep it from falling apart by embedding fibrous reinforcement in the outer layer of ice and wrapping cables and nets around it, somewhat like a butcher tying up a roast to prevent it from collapsing in the oven. This was a good match for the capabilities of the grimed, steel-armored, robots, which were mostly grabs. All of these robots needed power, of course. They could store a little of it in batteries, but those had to be recharged. Some of them collected energy from sunlight. Others had to converge from time to time on one of Ymir's little nuclear generators to sip electricity. The general picture was that Ymir would not be anything like the traditional idea of a spaceship, in the sense of an orderly, symmetrical piece of architecture. It would be more like a flying robotic anthill constructed out of a natural found object. The robots crawling around on and in it had general instructions as to what they were supposed to be doing, but could make their own judgments from moment to moment to avoid collisions with other robots, or from hour to hour as to when they needed to recharge their batteries. Or that had been the general scheme, anyway. Since there'd been no guessing what Sean would find, there'd been no way of coming up with any plan worthy of that name. Instead, they had sent him up with tools, resources, and ingenuity. Dinah, Marcus, Vyacheslav, and Giro were about to inherit the tools and the resources. Giro's inspector made steadily more noise as they approached, but the growth was slow enough that their minds didn't quite register it. Giro did not seem alarmed by the level of radioactivity, but Dinah didn't know how to interpret that. Earlier in the mission, she had probed him for some general background about what to expect.
"If it's very bad, we all just lose consciousness and the mission fails," he'd said. "The flux of radiation just shuts down our nerves, our sphincters open. We never even know it's happening." "In that case," Marcus had pointed out, somewhat testily, "there is little point in discussing that scenario." "If all four of us throw up," Giro had continued, "and say one or more of us gets diarrhea, then we have hours to live. In that case, we should just transmit a warning to Izzy and encourage them to send a second mission. In the meantime, maybe we can transmit some useful information to them. Inspector data, pictures, etc."
"Noted," Marcus had said.
"If, say, one of us throws up, then it means that half of us will probably die, and so we have some chance of accomplishing the mission. If no one is barfing, then none of us is likely to die, at least over a time span of weeks."
"Thanks for that," Dinah had said, and tried to put it out of her mind.
Now that they were actually approaching Ymir, however, it was coming back to her, and she was trying to convince herself that she wasn't feeling any nausea.
"I am going to traverse the nozzle mouth in about 30 seconds, Marcus announced.
"Roger," Giro said, and then switched off his inspector altogether.
He pulled up a window on the screen of his tablet. "Switching to the external gamma spec now." Suddenly, Ymir was filling the window. It was dead ahead of them. The glowing Earth, a third of 1,000,000 kilometers away, set below its black horizon as they sidled in behind it. Marcus had placed them on a trajectory that would slowly cross that of Ymir, bringing them laterally across the ice ship's aft end. Dinah's older relatives might have described Ymir as having a sugarloaf shape, meaning a cone with a blunted tip. If so, this sugarloaf had been splashed with boiling water and attacked with a screwdriver in several places, giving it a scarred, irregular form. But it clearly had a fat end and a narrow end. These were about half a kilometer apart. The fat end, which was beginning to swing across their field of view, was a couple of hundred meters wide. It had a big, circular hole in it, which was the outlet of the ice nozzle. New Caird could have flown into that hole and followed it almost all the way up to the throat before running out of room. And perhaps they would do so later, if they could find no other way in. But for now, they were just going to make a lazy swing across it. The edge of the hole was blurry because of the evanescent steam cloud leaking out of it. This looked not so much like rocket exhaust as like breath emerging from someone's mouth on a cold day. It didn't so much block their view as soften it. But the visual landscape of space was one of intense contrasts, and so it was impossible to see down into the nozzle bell, even when they were squarely in the middle of the cavernous hole. It was just a black disk, like staring into the muzzle of a rifle. Hair-thin needles of frost grew on the window as the steam condensed. Jiro focused intensely on his tablet until they had drifted past the midway point, then seemed to draw back into himself. He switched his inspector back on. It was making a lot more noise than it had a few minutes ago, but this gradually diminished as they traversed beyond the nozzle exit and across the wide base of the sugarloaf. With a tap on the thrusters, Marcus got them moving forward with respect to Ymir. Earth rose on her other side. New Caird moved up alongside the shard, headed for her forward end.
"What's the verdict, Jiro?"
Marcus asked, when he was satisfied with how things were going.
"Based on the gamma spec," Jiro said, "I would say that at least one of the fuel rods ruptured, not at the beginning when the rods were new, and not recently when they were full of fission fragments and daughters, but somewhere in between. Could be worse. Could be better."
A memory came back to Dinah. One of Sean's last messages said he was thrusting at full power. Jiro shrugged. "This reactor contains 1,600 fuel rods, grouped in assemblies of 40, so the failure of a single rod wouldn't measurably affect performance. Even the ruptured rod still makes power, remember? It's just that it would be spewing fuel fleas, fragments, and daughters into the rocket exhaust. We would expect to see a mixture of alpha, beta, and gamma, which is just what the inspector is reporting." Dinah was no nuclear physicist, but she'd had enough radiation facts drilled into her to get the gist. Gamma was high-energy light. It would pass through just about anything. So, bad news, good news. It was hard to shield against the stuff, but most of it passed right through your body without interacting. That is, without doing damage. It made scary noises on the inspector. Betas were free-flying electrons. They were easy to shield against. Good news, bad news. You could stop them with a little bit of water or plastic. But by the same token, if they came into contact with your body, they were certain to break something inside of you. Alphas were helium nuclei, 4,000 times as massive as betas, moving at relativistic speed. They could not pass quietly through matter any more than cannonballs could, but they did a lot of damage to whatever they hit. In order to detect anything other than gamma, Jiro had been forced to switch over to equipment mounted on the outside of New Caird, since alpha and beta couldn't penetrate the hull. And by looking at the energies of the various particles striking that equipment, he had been able to diagnose conditions inside the reactor. Since she could no longer see Ymir out the front window, Dinah focused on the slivers of frost that had grown on the glass. These were rapidly sublimating into space and would be gone in a few more minutes. She'd found them beautiful, until Jiro had made them aware that they were probably contaminated.
"Any residual beta now?" she asked.
"We are well clear of the nozzle and the plume," Jiro said, a little taken aback.
"I mean, did we pick up any contamination on that flyby?"
"It is back down to background levels," Jiro said, "but the detector would only see sources on each side of the hull. We will have to do a more thorough survey later."
"Get a load of this,"
Marcus said, and punched in a maneuver that swung New Caird around 90 degrees. They were now flying sideways, their nose aimed directly at Ymir, which was only about 100 meters away from them. She more than filled the window. Her narrow end, her bow, if you wanted to think of her as a ship, was a hill of dirty ice. A few fine structures suggested that humans had been at work there. Some structural netting, some cables, a glinting wire that might have been the radio aerial. But it wasn't obvious yet where they were actually going to dock.
"It is really buried,"
Marcus observed. He didn't have to explain that it was the command module, the part of Ymir that had life support systems. It ought to be reachable through a docking port, but they weren't seeing anything. They had known, because it was part of the plan, that Sean and his crew would have buried it in the ice to protect them from radiation and from rocks. They looked to have buried it deep. Dinah's tablet was running a terminal window, a simple programmer's interface that just displayed lines of text. For the last little while, this had shown only a blinking cursor. But now it came alive and began to display cryptic one-line messages.
"Picking up some new bot sigs," she reported.
These were the digital signatures of robots, pinging the universe to find out what, if anything, was listening. New Caird had shipped with a complement of robots of various types, but she knew all of their sigs and was filtering them out of this terminal window. Anything that showed up here was, by process of elimination, from Ymir's complement of robots. Like the clicks on Jiro's inspector, these came up sporadically and in bursts.
"At least 20, so I'm going to filter out the gnats," she said, typing in a command.
Being so numerous, gnats tended to overload the screen.
"Okay, in addition to a pretty well-developed gnat swarm, I have half a dozen grabs and at least that many Psywise."
"Any clues in their names?"
Marcus asked. It was possible to give each robot a unique name, which would show up on its sig.